From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It is Wednesday, July 25th. Hello, everybody. It is the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart at NPR News in New York, but I'm all alone because Luke Burbank, he's in Chicago. I'm not really alone, though.
No, I'm always with you. I'm like Obi-Wan Kenobi. I'll always be with you. I'm in Chicago doing Wait, Don't Tell Me this week. So due to the miracle of technology, I'm. It's like we're in the same room, Allie, and I think it's going to be a fun show. Speaking of fun, tomorrow on Capitol Hill, they're going to be debating the farm bill.
Woohoo, now, fun.
I know that when we came to this show, Allison, you said you want to talk about farming as much as possible. No, but seriously, it's actually much more interesting than you would sort of think. It's like a $300 billion program, and it's actually a program that knowingly pays dead people subsidies for farms that they owned when they were alive. People who make up to $2.5 million in income can still get subsidies. There's all this really interesting stuff about this program. So we're going to talk to NPR's Adam Davidson about that. I promise it's going to be less boring than you think it is.
Also, we're going to talk about all the Obama drama. It's day two of stories, as you know, and kind of keep you up to date on stories that made headlines. And then what happens after? What happened after the YouTube debate? One answer caused Hillary Clinton to call Barack Obama naive. Now, that is political snaps in the world of presidential politics. And also, hey, Luke, did you like the movie Wet Hot Summer?
Of course. American Summer.
I'm sorry, American Summer. If you like that film, then you're going to want to stick around because there's a new movie out called The Ten, about the Ten Commandments. And the co-writers and directors, that's Ken Marino and David Wayne, will be joining us live to talk about this new movie. Also, Janine Garofalo's in it. And in a brilliant turn, Winona Ryder takes on Thou Shalt Not Steal.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, stick around
That's
for that.
That's great. Way to go. Way to poke some fun at yourself, Winona. First, though, a kind of big story of the morning, I guess we think anyway, is the ongoing fallout of this guy, Tim Donaghy. He's the NBA referee who's being accused of betting on games and maybe point shaving. This is, just a possible giant problem for the NBA. And yesterday, David Stern, the commissioner of the league, had to have a press conference. Here's a little sample of what he said.
I don't know the number of games. I don't know which games. And until this moment, I have not deployed substantial amounts of people to do the work that would be necessary to satisfy us because I felt constrained by the FBI's request that we not communicate this to anybody.
This guy, Tim Donaghy, is expected to turn himself in to the FBI pretty soon. And if he starts singing and implicating maybe other referees or other people within the NBA, this could be so, so bad. A guy who's been following this really closely is Henry Abbott, who runs kind of the blog of record on the NBA, if you ask me, truehoop.com. Hi, Henry.
Hi, how are you doing, Luke?
I'm great. Thanks for talking to us. So just for people that have maybe only seen the headlines, what exactly is this referee, Tim Donaghy, what's he accused of doing?
Well, that's actually not the easiest question to answer. The funny thing is he's been charged with nothing. The story is really based on some reporting that broke over the weekend, or I guess on Friday, the New York Post, where there were leaks from the FBI to the New York Post about a Gambino crime family investigation that apparently picked up on a wiretap some information that an NBA referee was kind of under the influence of the mob and influencing games. But David Stern, who's, you know, he's got, I guess, the best information of anybody, really, is he's been working with the FBI. He said yesterday that the two things that they know to have been alleged are that, an NBA referee bet on NBA games. That's one of the allegations. Another one is that he provided information to people, I think, so that they could profit on betting on games. What is not clear, David Stern was very squirrely on this point, although it's been reported a million different ways, was whether or not this referee, Tim Donaghy, bet on or influenced or made calls in games that he was working in to influence the outcome of those games. Obviously, that would be the thing everyone would be most worried about.
Yeah, they've been trying to. It's and very like New York Times and stuff have been trying to figure that out by looking at the betting lines on games that Donaghy worked and trying to talking to bookies about if the money was moving in sort of weird ways. What do you? I mean, is this something that you think the NBA should have known about or could have known about if it in fact happened?
Well, people are really hard on the NBA on this topic, but I didn't hear anybody calling for more like scrutiny of referees, you know, being influenced by gamblers before this happened. So I don't think it was like everybody was just all aware it was a big problem. The NBA, you know, Davis Stern went on this big list of, you know, he dropped names like CIA, FBI, every law enforcement agency you've ever heard of is involved in some fashion, and like ex-people from those organizations work for the NBA and somehow trying to prevent those kind of stuff. It sounds like this really intense dragnet. I don't know if it's that intense, but they had investigated this referee before for what would seem to me to be a totally unrelated thing, which was getting in a big dispute with his neighbor, and they were upset about it and, you know, told him never to get in that kind of dispute again, and if he did, he would be in trouble. There were some stories about him getting in fistfights with a colleague or a couple other times just being a hothead.
Right, and also he apparently was, somebody said they had seen him or he had been gambling in Atlantic City, which is totally prohibited. So they apparently the NBA said they investigated and they didn't find any evidence he had been in Atlantic City, so it sounded like they did some work on it.
Yeah, they, you know, I thought Davis Stern was pretty convincing on that point. When this first thing first happened for several days, I got about 100 emails a day of people saying, why would they let a guy who was like alleged to have a gambling problem, you know, keep refereeing NBA games? And, you know, Stern said very clearly that there was one allegation in the middle of a separate dispute with a neighbor, and they called him in, and he said it wasn't true. It was really, you know, just his neighbor making stuff up, and they sent, he said they checked with every casino in Atlantic City and Las Vegas to see if he was a figure there, if this referee was someone who was there gambling a lot. And just to explain, like, the reason they care about gambling on, you know, non-NBA games is because if you lose a bunch of money, you know, as a gambler in any event, you could then become under the influence of somebody who could, you know, have creative ideas about how you could pay them back.
Yeah, I think that part of why this story is getting so much attention, particularly with NBA fans, is because every NBA fan feels like the refs have been conspiring against their team. As a Seattle Supersonic fan, I can tell you specific incidents where I know that the NBA tried to thwart us in the championship. I don't want to talk about the Phoenix
series. It's every
team. Right, so everyone now, suddenly there's like this reason. It's like suddenly, oh, actually there was a guy who was maybe crooked. So do you think that's part of this?
Oh, yeah, and this, you know, this particular year there were two big referee incidents that had everybody all fired up. There was a referee who, you know, who chucked Tim Duncan out of a game and was suspended for, Joey Crawford was suspended for, you know, I can't remember now.
I think he was the next game or maybe the rest of the series. I think it was the rest of the series.
No, I'm pretty sure he's banned for life, to be honest.
From the playoffs?
From the NBA. I should know my facts here. Sorry about that. But you know, then
there'll be an update on TrueHoop.com coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Henry, we're actually running out of time
okay.
here, but we'll be checking back in with you on this, I'm sure, because you know, Allison wants the show to be about the farm bill, but I really want it to be about the NBA. So there'll be a lot to talk
about. The farm
bill. All right, Henry Abbott of TrueHoop.com. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Let's get some more headlines with NPR News' Matt Martinez. Matt?
I don't trust you.
Blunt talk from Senator Patrick Leahy. He was talking to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The AG appeared at a Senate Judiciary Oversight hearing yesterday. Congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle pommeled Gonzalez, coming very close to accusing him of perjury over previous testimony on the administration's warrantless surveillance program. Here's Senator Arlen Specter, the ranking Republican on the committee.
So my suggestion to you that you review your testimony very carefully. The chairman has already said that the committee is going to review your testimony very carefully to see if your credibility has been breached to the point of being actionable.
Taliban militants say they shot and killed one South Korean hostage today in Afghanistan. The Taliban said the Afghan government failed to release any Taliban prisoners in exchange for the hostages. But Western officials say some of the 23 Korean captives were freed and taken to a U.S. military base. and a South Korean news agency is reporting 8 Koreans have been released. The River Thames burst its banks today. That forced the evacuation of hundreds of homes in Oxford. Britain is experiencing its worst floods in 60 years. About 350,000 people faced 2 weeks without running water. Insurance claims could soar up to £3 billion, or $6.2 billion. Iran says it is open to higher-level talks with the United States. That's the latest to come out of talks between the two countries in Baghdad this week. The Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, said that by talking to the United States, it could help restore stability to Iraq. The Baghdad talks are the highest-profile face-to-face dialogue between Iran and the United States since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. MySpace said it deleted 29,000 convicted sex offenders on its service. The service has come under attack over the past year after some of its members fell prey to adult predators posing as minors. The families of several teenage girls sexually assaulted by MySpace members sued the service in January. MySpace attracts about 60 million unique visitors monthly in the United States. And Barry Bonds went 1-for-5 with a single and a walk last night. Atlanta won 7-5 after the Giants forced extra innings with 4 runs in the bottom of the 9th. Bonds is still too shy of Hank Aaron's 755 home run record. Commissioner Bud Selig was in the crowd and says he'll try to be on hand when Bonds hits the home run that breaks Aaron's record. Those are the latest headlines from NPR News. The news is always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
Thank you, Matt. As promised, Luke, we told all of our listeners when we first started the Bryant Park Project, we were going to continue to follow stories past the first day that they're in the headlines. And we have a good day two story today because it involves a fight. There was the YouTube debates. That was the big story. Everybody talked about, was it good? Was it bad? How did the Democratic candidates do? Well, there was one question and two different answers from the front runners, which has morphed into sort of a big story today. First of all, here's the original question.
Would you be willing to meet separately without precondition during the first year of your administration in Washington or anywhere else with the leaders of Iran, Syria, Venezuela, Cuba, and North Korea? In order to bridge the gap that divides our countries.
Senator Obama?
I would. And the reason is this, that the notion that somehow not talking to countries is punishment to them, which has been the guiding diplomatic principle of this administration, is ridiculous.
Well, I'd be interested in knowing what Hillary has to say to that question.
Senator Clinton?
Well, I will not promise to meet with the leaders of these countries during my first year. I will promise a very vigorous diplomatic effort, because I think it is not that you promise a meeting at that high a level before you know what the intentions are. I don't want to be used for propaganda purposes. I don't want to make a situation even worse.
And so, of course, Hillary Clinton, I think her camp felt like she got a little traction with that tete-a-tete. So she did not let the chance go to bring it up again, and she was talking to the Quad City Times. Only during presidential season is the Quad City Times getting interviews with Hillary Clinton.
That's because in Iowa, where they're going to have a big old caucus.
So here's what she said to the Quad City Times.
I thought that was irresponsible and frankly naive to say that you would commit to meeting with Chavez and Castro and others within the first year.
Now go to your room, Barack Obama, go to your room. That's what it sounds like. But Barack Obama, nobody puts Barack Obama in a corner. Here's his response.
If you want to talk about irresponsibility and naivete, look at her vote to authorize George Bush to send our troops into Iraq with an exit plan.
As you can imagine, the blogosphere has gone wild with this back and forth. The well-known conservative blogger Hugh Hewitt wrote on townhall.com, a conservative blog. He wrote, Senator Clinton had the common sense to say no. She wouldn't make such a commitment, that commitment to talk to leaders. She got a lot of problems as a candidate, but always pandering to the give peace a chance crowd isn't one of them.
And then a blogger who goes by the name Mother Davis, she said that she agrees with Obama, said she's disappointed in Clinton. Here's exactly what she said. It's a sad day for the Democratic Party when the supposed frontrunner for president of the United States refers to talk as irresponsible. The only thing to which face-to-face talks between the American president and the leaders of other nations is irresponsible is the status quo. Frankly, the status quo is rotten. As for naivete, well, naivete is much preferred to fatalism.
Well, we want to know what you think. Was Barack Obama's answer, his choice, naive? Is this politics as usual? What do you think about the whole thing? Please email us on the issue. You can send those emails to our brand new inbox, bryantpark@npr.org.
Beautiful. Hey, Allison, you know, we have these editorial meetings and there's lots of little stories that we're not quite ready to do a full segment on, but we definitely think people want to hear about them. And that's why we've made a special little place in the show we like to call The Ramble.
And I like
with
that it has
special,
its own.
With special little music. Every time I talk about the music every time we do it because I just think it's the coolest music they're playing on NPR these days.
Well, apparently dozens of Tour de France riders, they didn't start the race at the 16th stage. They were mad, mad, mad. It's a protest about a star rider and his team sent home after testing positive for a banned blood transfusion. The most excitement to happen at the Tour de France since that dog ran in the road.
Yeah, I know. Producer Dan was talking about how, you know, basically people now, all they care about in the Tour de France is who's getting kicked out for doping, who's in trouble for using steroids. And maybe someone actually rides a race sometime, but nobody really notices. The Muppets are moving right along all the way to Hotlanta. The Jim Henson Foundation is donating 500 to 700 Muppets that have played Muppets, so I guess the actual puppets,
yeah,
including some of the first Muppets ever built, to the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta. I'm going to check that out next time I'm in the 407.
Exactly. Kermit, Miss Piggy dressed as Scarlett O'Hara. I'd go. Anyway, hey, federal air marshals have been put on alert by the TSA. Apparently, four curious, I'm just going to call them things, were found at four different airports. And this, they were seized, and it was included a block of cheese, wires, switches, and cell phone components. And when you figure, what the heck does cheese and cell phone components have to do with terrorism? The airport security officers were worried that perhaps someone is trying to create or practice getting explosive components onto airplanes. Perhaps the cheese has the same consistency as some sort of explosive. They have said clearly there is no threat, but the airports, just in case you were curious, San Diego, Baltimore, Milwaukee, and Houston.
You know, and I usually think that these security measures are maybe a little over the top, but I saw a photo of this block of cheese with the cell phone component strapped to it. It looks shady. I cannot understand why someone would necessarily need to bring that thing through. A new study has found that people who drink diet soda had the same risk of heart disease as people who drank regular soda. This was like a big headline that got splashed around the other day because everyone was saying, wait a minute, diet. And people kind of, I think, misconstrued it a little bit. Is diet soda causing diabetes? Is diet soda causing heart disease? Researchers, they sort of had expected to find that there were going to be lower rates of heart disease among people who were drinking diet soda. And in fact, we've got the guy who conducted this study, Vasan Ramachandran. He's a professor of medicine at Boston University. He wrote about this, and I think we have him on the telephone line. I assume it's Dr. Ramachandran, is that right?
That's correct. Good morning, Luke and Allison.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for coming on. Now this study you put out, I think I've been seeing you kind of trying to explain what you actually found out. What did you actually find out?
Right. This is a study based on the observations in the Framingham Heart Study. And we took approximately observations from 6,000 participants who were free of the metabolic syndrome, which is a combination of risk factors that predisposes people to diabetes and heart disease. And we ascertained their consumption of cola, and we followed them over a period of 4 years and related the development of new onset metabolic syndrome to the consumption of cola. And what we found was that individuals who drank one or more soda per day had a 50% increased risk of developing this combination of risk factors called the metabolic syndrome. And as you alluded to at the beginning of the program, it did not seem to make a difference whether this more than one soda per day was the regular kind or the diet kind.
Well, I think that's because people think diet soda, someone who drinks diet soda must be watching their weight, might be concerned about their overall health. So that seems to be the big headline, that it's the diet soda that's the problem.
Right, Allison. I think just to step back and to clarify, what we report in observational studies such as the Framingham study is an association. We do not establish causality, and what we show is that individuals who drank one or more soda per day had a greater probability of developing the metabolic syndrome. And part of the issue, going back to your question, is that it may be the soda drinker or it may be the soda. And I'd be happy to explain both these points of view.
In terms of it being the soda drinker, it's just the person may not be all that healthy, correct, in the first place?
Right. We know that individuals who drink soda, they have a dietary pattern that includes greater intake of calories, more of saturated and trans fats, less of fiber, and a sedentary lifestyle. Now, mind you, we adjusted for these factors in our analysis. And even after this adjustment for all these factors, there was a residual 50% increased risk of developing this combination of risk factors. But one can argue that it's pretty difficult to adjust totally for lifestyle-related factors, and the association we observe may still reflect a dietary pattern or lifestyle of the soda drinker.
So it sounds like, diet soda, regular soda, we should all shake a leg and try to keep a little bit of exercise going on, kind of watching what we're eating. Diet soda is not some sort of insulator against ever getting sick.
That's my own opinion, Luke. I think you nailed it. One has to eat healthy, exercise regularly, and keep an ideal body weight.
Wow, the doctor told me I nailed it. Dr. Ramachandran, Dr. Vasan Ramachandran from Boston University, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Luke and Allison.
I'm not calling you Dr. Burbank just because you nailed it, Luke. That's not.
In certain parts of Colorado, I am legally a doctor. We can explain that after the show. Speaking of soda, coming up, we're going to find out why is there corn in Coca-Cola and in your gas tank and in your carpet? The answer actually has a lot to do with this farm bill that we're going to talk about.
NPR's own Adam Davidson, who just came into the room and sat down so very quietly. He's right over there. You're going to fill us in, right, Adam?
I am.
All right, on the farm bill, its effects. We appreciate that. And Luke?
Also, we're going to have actress, comedian, and former Daily Show correspondent Stacey Grenrock Woods. She's going to be here to talk about her new book, I, California. That's all coming up on the Bryant Park Project. The U.S. House of Representatives is getting ready to debate the farm bill tomorrow, which, you know, does maybe not sound like the sexiest topic ever, but it's actually, I've been reading about it the last couple of days, and it's super interesting. It's this gigantic, gigantic program that's controlled by this tiny group of Midwest Congress people who you've probably never heard of, and there are all these weird parts of the program. Like, it's actually written in there that someone who's dead can still get subsidies, and people who seem to be making a lot of money, like up to $2.5 million, can still get subsidies. So we thought we would find out a little bit more about this program that happens, I think, every 5 years. Well, Adam will tell us. Adam Davidson is NPR's international business and economics correspondent, and sounds like he's there in New York rustling around. Hi, Adam.
Hey. What's up, Luke?
Hey, man. So, like, for people who haven't already turned off their radio or iPod or whatever we broadcast on right now, why should the non-farmers of America care about this? Why is this sort of a big deal?
Well, this year I find it particularly interesting because there's this sort of epic battle. You have on the one side farmers and their congressmen, or at least some farmers, not all farmers, but the most powerful farmers. And on the other side, you have this interesting coalition of left-wing and right-wing groups, environmentalists, libertarians, people who care about poverty, people who care about the poor in other countries, this big left-right coalition that thought this was the year we're going to finally show it to those huge agribusiness folks and destroy their farm bill. We find out tomorrow who wins, although right now the Vegas odds, the smart money, is on agribusiness.
So because there's all this money, I mean, this is like in the 30s that the farm bill was established, right? And it was sort of to help farmers out, but it's evolved into this other thing where these gigantic as they're being called agribusinesses, have locked up a lot of this money, right? Who are sort of the big winners under the current farm bill?
Well, it really is a narrow group that gets the bulk of the money. Something like 70% of the tens of billions of dollars goes to just 30 congressional districts. And 20 of those districts get an even huger share of that money. It goes disproportionately to the wealthiest farmers. It goes disproportionately, well, it almost the vast bulk goes to just a handful of crops, corn, cotton, rice. Sugar is often mentioned. They don't get direct payments, but the farm bill limits the importation of sugar from other countries, so all Americans pay considerably more for sugar than we would without the farm bill. So sugar basically gets billions of dollars. If you're, you know, so the benefits are concentrated, small number of people, small number of congressional districts, small number of crops. But for those people, the farm bill is all that matters. If you represent one of these congressional districts, mm-hmm. basically your job is to get the farm bill passed. And you are willing to vote on whatever Iraq war legislation or whatever other legislation some other congressman wants you to vote on to get his vote on the farm bill. And if you're...
corn prices, some of these crops, the prices are at like a record high.
Well, at least in theory, the farm bill subsidies are to help farmers during tough times. And, you know, there's price supports. There's a variety of programs to help farmers survive those times when prices are low. Now, with corn at record prices, I heard one of the American Farm Bureau lobbyists argue that the farm bill needs to be changed because so many corn growers are not getting subsidies because they're making too much money in the marketplace, which is nuts. I mean, if they're making
they were going to raise the limit. So it's like, well, if you're making $4 million a year, you can still get subsidies, basically.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, I picked that number out of the air. I don't think anyone's proposing $4 million, but essentially, they were saying the problem is people are making too much money selling corn, so we need to change the formula.
Right, so that they can actually get money, as if the goal of the farm bill is to get money to corn growers. The goal, in theory, is to help agriculture during difficult times, but in practice, it is transferring money from, you know, 415 congressional districts, from the vast majority of Americans, to a small number of Americans. It doesn't even go to the poor family farmers so much. It goes to the wealthiest farmers disproportionately.
We're just about out of time, Adam, but I wanted to ask, what would happen if they just canned this whole program, if they just took it off the table? I mean, would the American farms collapse? Would it be, you know, terrible, or would it be good?
Well, it wouldn't affect the vast majority of crops, you know, fruits and nuts and beans and, you know, it would affect corn, cotton, sugar and rice, soybeans. It would affect them dramatically. Their lobbyists argue, yes, you would see none of this stuff grown in America. It would all come in from overseas, and Mexico or China or whoever wants to starve America could do so. The economists don't see that. Certainly, you'd see less production in the U.S., but, you know, the way markets generally work is if there's dramatically lower supply, the prices go up. That encourages people to grow more. So probably not. I will note that several environmental groups, several anti-poverty groups say the farm bill is the single most destructive thing that the government does to the environment and to the poor. So you would see a lot of benefits to those groups.
Well, interesting you would bring that up, because I think the next guy we're going to talk to will sort of get more into that specifically with corn. Adam Davidson, do I always have to say this? International Business and Economics Correspondent?
You can just say NPR's Adam Davidson.
NPR's Adam Davidson. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Luke.
NPR's Adam Davidson, you sit tight. I saw you about to leave. I want you to stick around just in case I miss something on this interview, because I've been trying to read up on the farm bill. And it is just so enormous trying to digest, pardon the pun, all the information about the farm bill right now. Dan Imhoff is joining us in the studio. He wrote the book Food Fight, as well as the book Paper or Plastic, Searching for Solutions to an Overpackaged World. Paper's better, right, Dan?
Neither is better.
Neither is better. Yeah. Cloth is best.
Cloth is the way to go.
You've been listening in on this conversation, and I was, as I said, I've been reading or trying to read around, trying to read a lot of opinion about the Farm Bill. And one blog wrote, "The Farm Bill is the most important piece of food legislation currently up for debate, and the outcome will affect farmers and consumers alike." Can you explain, Dan, to the average person, three ways, and well, the way the Farm Bill affects my life?
Well, sure. The Farm Bill really should be called the Food and Farm Bill. And I think, you know, it started way back in the Depression and in times when they were nobly trying to make up for differences between the farm economy and the urban industrial economy. But if you pay taxes, if you shop, if you eat, if your kids are at school, if you care about the fate of small farmers in this country or farmers in other countries, then the Farm Bill directly affects you.
That's one of the oddest things about the Farm Bill is that it encompasses everything from food stamps and school lunches to what somebody decides they're going to plant. Of all the organizations that have been lobbying about this, and one article I read said 475 organizations have reported lobbying about the Farm Bill. Who has the most sway and why, in your opinion?
Well, it remains to be seen. We're right in the middle of the biggest food fight that we've had since the 1930s. And, you know, I think Adam has just laid it out that right now it looks like big food, big ag. You know, the people who directly benefit from the Farm Bill are those not necessarily even the large family farmers that farm corn, cotton, wheat, rice, or soybeans or milk, but rather the big companies that are buying cheap ingredients, feed, mm-hmm. or basically, you know, corn and soybeans, things that make sugars, oils, starches, all the building blocks of an industrial food economy. Those are the ones with the most to gain. They're pumping tens of millions of dollars into Washington. However, also, as Adam said, this year is this kind of critical mass year where there are hundreds of groups, there are tons of average citizens that are waking up and saying, wow, this affects me and I have a say and I want my representatives to vote the right way in this. And
what could be the biggest improvement made? If someone came to you and said, okay, you could change two things about the Farm Bill that would really improve the average person's life, what would they be?
The first one would be a shift from an emphasis on overproduction of commodities towards things with real benefits like conservation. So rather than rewarding someone for how much they produce, to how they produce it and steward the land. And then the second would really be also much more of a diversification, like using our money to rebuild local food chains and regional food chains in our areas because we're so reliant on processed faraway foods.
Let me ask you a little bit. I actually want to play a piece of a tape from a forum that you were involved in at UC Berkeley.
Okay.
Back on the 21st. It was a webcast, and there was a family farmer there, George Naylor, who's become somewhat of an activist, mm-hmm. and he was talking a little bit about the trade issue. Let's play George's soundbite, and I'll get you to respond.
And then when it is dawns on everybody that, well, a farm economy is not going to operate on that manner, that if a farmer went into the banker and said, oh, I need some money to plant my crop this spring, and the banker said, well, you realize how low your prices are? You're not making any money now, and for all we know, the price might be even lower by the time you harvest your next crop. The banker wouldn't loan the farmer any money, so the system would not work.
He has big issues with free trade. That actually wasn't the right soundbite, I'll be honest with you. His big issue is with free trade in terms of the amount of food that comes in and out of the country and how it affects the small family farmer. How does our Farm Bill affect other economies?
Well, it distorts the market. I mean, basically what we're saying is we're going to artificially set a price for a crop. And if the market falls below that price, then the government's going to compensate and pay the difference. And also, though, another thing that these subsidies are really doing is driving surpluses. They're driving surpluses that are only there to be exported. So, and when we export these distorted mm-hmm. priced commodities on the market, then it hurts farmers in other countries that are growing the same crops.
Before I let you go, I know that we were talking about the environment quite briefly. Is there anything proposed in this particular Farm Bill which is beneficial to the environment? Can you think of something where the Farm Bill perhaps would make a great stride?
Again, I think it really remains to be seen. Great strides, I think, would limit overproduction and go toward commodities. And conservation.
Conservation.
I think there are moves in that direction, and also big strides towards making this link between subsidized food and nutrition. That's driving our obesity crisis. So,
because
you know,
of the corn and the wheat and the starch versus farmers who are growing vegetables and fruits.
Exactly. Healthier foods for our children. I think that could be a huge step. That's what I'm hoping for.
I'm going to end on that note. It's a good note to end on. Dan Imhoff, thank you so much for coming on in and helping us out. Adam, thanks for sticking around, too. I appreciate it.
You know, Allison, as you've no doubt been hearing a lot of, there's been people lining up around bookstores and wearing kind of ridiculous costumes and, you know, making up songs and stuff. Just people are obsessed with this book. It's, you know, really one of the biggest books, I'd say, in maybe the last 5 years. I speak, of course, of I, California by Stacy Grenrock Woods, which, by the way, I don't know actually, because I'm in Chicago, if we have Stacy in the cockpit yet.
She is, and she's laughing. She's smiling.
Broadly. Stacy, you have the...
You were talking about Harry Potter, though, right?
Well, that's comedy, because you thought I was going to say one thing, but then I kind of switched it.
That's how comedy works.
Yeah, because it was totally unexpected when I did that. I think the cover photo for your book is maybe, if there was an award for that,
Where's
the Booker Prize for cover shot?
They must give some sort of design prize or something. Well, that photo was taken by my older sister.
And you have on some sunglasses you stole from Judith Light, maybe like a set of Who's the Boss or something?
Yes, very, very, very good. Good eye. Yes, those were Judith Light's sunglasses.
You have in your book a lot of really great diary entries, and I was just wondering, they're so funny. I was wondering, are those real? Did you really write that stuff when you were a kid, or is it?
I absolutely did, and I have the original documents to prove it if I'm ever called into court or anything. Yeah, those are
your James Fry moment.
Exactly. Yeah. those are my sixth grade journal entries. You know, my sixth grade fiction, actually.
Wow.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, you had a much more literary kind of inner life at sixth grade than I did.
You think? Well, maybe that's because that teacher that I didn't like, you know, maybe she really knew what she was talking about, making us write those journals.
And
maybe
you
I owe
you
her
were,
a debt of gratitude.
You guys were brats? What did she call you, a brat or something?
She called
you
us
so
snobs.
Mad?
And she was right. I'm sure she was. You know, we went to this private school. It was kind of a cheap private school, but everybody was, you know, pretty snobby little sixth graders. And yeah, she called us snobs. And I didn't think that was right.
This is kind of your memoir of growing up in the San Fernando Valley, which is north of Los Angeles. And why did you feel like the world was ready to hear your tale of growing up in the valley?
Oh, I didn't feel, it didn't occur to me that the world was ready for it at all. I just felt like writing it.
I need some money.
Yeah,
I wasn't doing much.
I mean, I'm a writer and I wanted to write a book, so that's what I write. I wasn't really, saying, hey, world, would you like to hear about me in Sherman Oaks? I just figure I'll write it. If they want to hear about it, they'll read it.
I have to ask a completely obnoxious question.
Oh, please.
When you start, you have a beautiful speaking voice.
Thank you.
And I was kind of expecting maybe some valley. Did you ever have the accent? Did you live to lose the accent?
Well,
the valley girl, LA thing?
It's surprising that you say that, because I think it comes across to certain people, but if you're not hearing it, that's good. I think if you loaded the studio with like three or four valley girls, I'd probably slip into
it. And a cocktail?
And maybe a cocktail, yeah. No, I'd probably slip into it. I mean, it's certainly doable, you know. When I get around some other valley girls, it's sort of like, oh, wow, hey, that's great. Oh, my God. Oh, wow. But, yeah, I try to avoid it.
At least you haven't been accused on the air like I was by this musical guest of sounding like a valley girl. My first question, he goes, yeah, he totally started doing like Moon Unit Zappa valley girl action back to me. I know.
Why, are you from the valley?
No, but I just actually recently moved from L.A. to New York, and I am a huge, huge fan of L.A., but I feel like a lot of people be hating on the Los Angeles, and I guess you grew up there. What do you think, what is it that people don't get, about people who are not such big fans of the L.A.? What is it they're not getting about the experience?
I think a lot of the creepy people that you hear about and maybe associate with Los Angeles and some of the goings on, I think those are from people who basically come to L.A., you know, hoping to strike it rich, you know, just like it's always been. Gold Rush, you know, Lucy and Ricky, we're going to California kind of thing. I mean, I'm glad my parents came for that very reason, but I think a lot of people must come to L.A. with very sinister intentions, and that certainly, you know, affects the mood of the city for sure. But I guess you get that with any big city.
Was it a fun place to grow up, you think?
Well, I have nothing to compare it to, but I sure did have a good time because, you know, you could just go to the store and see Richard Dreyfuss, or, you know, there would be shooting, you know, Eight Is Enough down the street or something. It was always something kind of fun like that.
You know, you worked at The Daily Show a long while ago, which is when I first became a very big fan of your work.
And oh, thank you.
Now that it is so blowed up, is there a little part of you that's like, why did I get off that train?
Well, I like to do that with shows. I like to join them early, and then they get really popular.
Leave
and
before
then I'm
the peak.
Gone. Yeah, exactly.
You know. Yeah.
Same
before
thing
it gets
with
crowded.
Arrested Development. Same thing. No, because I did it for about, I don't know, 7 years
while,
or something.
Yeah.
And you can only do that for so long, you know. I think I was just ready to do something else. But, yeah, no, I don't feel that.
Well, I have to say that we're very happy that you are doing something else, including writing this book, because it's a great read. It was cracking me up.
Oh, good. That was my intention. Thank you.
Perfect. Stacey Grenrock-Woods is the author of iCalifornia. She's also sex advice columnist for Esquire.
That's true.
Thanks for talking to us on the old Bryant Park Project.
Thank you for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, here I come.
The Ten, as in Commandments, is a new movie about all the thou shalls and shalt nots, which make up that heavy-duty instruction manual that God gave to Moses. No signs of Mo in the film, but you will see members of the comedy troupe The State, Saturday Night Live, Stella, The Daily Show, Reno 911, with the help of some nudity, prison boyfriends, and poo jokes to illustrate the biblical do's and don'ts. Now, when it comes to Commandment number 7, Famke Janssen's question to Paul Rudd, who plays her husband, is about his newfound fascination with his pecs.
9. 10. Oh. Sorry about that. I'm a bit of a health fiend.
Oh. Since when do you exercise?
What are you talking about? I found this downstairs. I thought I'd give my pecs a little juice.
Give your pecs a little juice?
What? Juice in my pecs?
I don't know. Something you're not telling me about the pec juice.
What do you think, Gretchen? I'm screwing around on you? Oh, wait, no, let me guess. I met some girl at a coffee shop, and we made jokes about the little cardboard things you put over a cup so you don't burn your hands. And then we went out to my car, and I screwed her twice.
I wasn't saying that at all.
Well, then, can I...
Oh, please, do your thing.
The Tens writers join as Ken Marino, who also stars in the movie, and David Wayne, who directed the film as well. It's really good to see you guys.
It's good to see you, too.
Great to see you, too.
You know, if you listen carefully in that clip, you'll get a little subtle hint of what he really did, like how he had the affair.
I like that about the movie, that it's that subtle, those touches like that.
We're not trafficking in too much subtlety.
Why is Paul Rudd being accused of cheating in every movie in America right now?
Oh, by the way, I just have to let you know.
What's going on?
My co-host Luke is in the Chicago Bureau. You just freaked out. Wow. David and Ken in the biggest way.
Hi, Luke. I'm actually a quado. I live in Allison's stomach and I have a mic, so I hope that's not going to be awkward.
Now that you explained
the listeners
it,
have to understand we're here alone in the booth with Allison, and then we hear this voice, but that's great.
So wait, David, let's get back to this. To the beginning.
Oh.
Did you always have a burning desire to write a movie, a biblical comedy?
Well, you know, it's really not even so much a biblical comedy. We use the Ten Commandments as kind of a jumping-off point thematically for these 10 stories that we wanted to tell. And, you know, if you go see it, you'll see it's not really a religious creed on any level. It's much more of just a silly laugh fest.
Was there any one commandment, Ken, that was hard to develop a vignette about that was particularly tough to figure out? How do we craft an 8-minute comedy fest about this?
You know, there were a couple of commandments that were very similar to each other, like adultery and covet thy neighbor's wife. And so we had to kind of get a little creative with our interpretation of what those commandments.
Like that, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife turns out to be set in an all-male prison among three male prisoners.
Yes.
You know? We wanted
to
make
sure. You're the wife, Ken, in that one, by the way.
I am the wife, yeah.
We tried to make things less obvious and less familiar, you know, fresher.
Casting is such a big part of this movie.
Yeah.
It's some of the casting is hilarious. You have Oliver Platt, who I'd watch do anything. He's so great. But Winona Ryder taking on Thou Shalt Not Steal.
Totally.
Considering she was busted and put on trial for shoplifting. How did that conversation go?
You know,
approaching Ms. Ryder.
It was a true coincidence, that little connection. And we had gotten in touch with Winona Ryder because we just loved her. And she gave me a call and said, listen, I had seen your previous film, Wet Hot American Summer, and I would do anything in your movie. I was so happy. And I said, well, the big part we have is the protagonist in the Thou Shalt Not Steal. And she said, perfect. And only then did it occur to me that connection. But then she showed up on set and was just unbelievable. And she's, you know, she's on fire.
Was it an elephant in the room? Did anybody ever discuss it with her, Ken?
I didn't talk about it.
It wasn't like talked about that much, but I don't think, I mean, she would bring it up sometimes. Like she knew that she had been arrested for shoplifting.
She was quite aware.
She remembers.
That judge in the robe probably clued her in.
There was an elephant in the room, but then she kind of moved slowly towards the door with it under her
That's right.
dress and then out the door and then stole
Obviously
it.
One of the biggies, the biggies is Thou Shalt Not Kill.
Yes.
And can you play a doctor who likes to joke
a
little
goof
bit?
Goof around.
Likes to goof around. Let's play this clip of how he goofs around a little bit.
You left a pair of scissors inside of my wife?
Yes, that's correct.
How can you make a mistake like that?
Oh, no. It wasn't a mistake. I did it as a goof.
You goofed?
No, relax. As a goof. I did it as a goof.
I don't get it.
Well, clearly, you just don't know me. I goof a lot. My friends know that at least half the time I am goofing. The thing is, you need to understand my sense of humor. I think that's it.
Was it hard for you in any way? Or I shouldn't even put that word out there. What was it like for you to be in a movie that you co-wrote when you've got to sort of have two heads and you're saying the words and you're acting, you're thinking, God, that was a great line I just wrote, or why did I put that way?
Well, David's there to kind of control that. If a line is not working, he'll come in and say, we need to change that. But
bring more film when Ken was on set.
We usually got through my stuff like one word at a time. And if you notice, we cut away from me a lot. I did a lot of my work in post. You know, David and I have been doing this kind of stuff, wearing several hats, you know, making stuff for a while. And so it's fun and it's easy. It's not like overwhelming to, you know, be a writer on it and then be an actor. And
I think we both operate under the idea that the filmmaking and the performing are two sides of the same coin and two arms of the same octopus.
What other analogies can we get there?
Two slices of the same stick of butter.
Peas in the same pod. You guys work together a lot, and you have this troop of folks who are friends, and I'm assuming friends, and you do all sorts of different projects together.
And we were all friends with you back in the MTV days.
Back in the day, way back. I think you guys were a little cooler than I was. I aspired
to
friendship.
That's not how we saw it. We saw it the opposite way.
I was in the chess club. MTV News was like the chess club of MTV.
And you had a quado, which was kind of...
It was always weird.
Working with the same people again and again and again can be really fun, but how do you do it again and again and keep it fresh so that you don't sort of fall back on patterns or just kind of amuse yourselves?
Well, I would say that by using a lot of working a lot with the same people and the same collaborators, it actually helps us evolve our craft more and more because you're not necessarily reinventing the vocabulary every time, and you can actually go deeper comedically into things. And so I think it's been a great thing that we've worked with all these same people, but we all also continually bring new people into the fold. And the great thing I love about the 10 is the mixture of like guys that we've worked with since we met the first day of college and people we met just on this film, all kind of integrating. It was great.
What do you think, Ken? How do you keep it interesting and new when it's a lot of the same folks you've seen over the course of your professional career and your personal life?
I mean, I think just what David was saying, you know, you have a shorthand with all your friends that you create with, and so it's you are moving forward, and you get to play a little bit more, and you get to kind of, you know, when you're with people and you joke around, and there's
a comfort zone.
Over time you have to kind of step it up to impress them or make them laugh or, you know, kind of come up with something fresh. And
I also think when you're around people that you trust and you're comfortable with, then you can access your own instincts so much easier. And I think that's what makes our work maybe unique and probably the best stuff out there.
Ever in the world. Hey, do a little bit of plugging for me. Tell me where, when, how, the 10.
The movie opens in 10 cities in about 27 theaters on August 3rd, and then every week after that expands to more and more cities. Our website is the10movie.com. You can see where everything's happening. And there's also, you can see on the website other events related to the film.
Okay.
There's an event on the 2nd, right?
Yeah, August 2nd at the Gramercy Theater in New York is a whole evening of music and comedy and a little sneak preview of one scene from the film, and you can get a kind of a pre-celebration premiere event.
It's a really good movie. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I'm so glad for you guys. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. Ken and
Anytime.
David. It's really good. Luke, I'll give you my copy of the DVD when you get back to New York, okay?
Yeah, I was jelly that you got to see the movie before I did.
Did you say jelly?
You know what? Here's the problem. I have a 13-year-old daughter who I've been trapped in a hotel room with for like the last 2 weeks, and I'm starting to talk like Hannah Montana.
Is the lock stuck?
It has a chain, and I haven't figured out. I don't know. I can't believe I said that.
Well,
that is so Raven.
I'm jelly that you're watching so much Hannah Montana.
Yeah, Billy Ray Cyrus' daughter. Who knew you were such a thespian?
Hey, what up?
Did you know that's Billy Ray Cyrus' daughter?
I know. Yes, I did know that. And I also know that Billy Ray Cyrus is a Hunkosaurus Rex. And he can dance like nobody's business.
He's a Billy Ray Cyrus Rex. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And thank you for, you know, talking from her stomach.
It's part of our shtick. Hey, let's get a little bit of the news from Matt Martinez.
Yeah, do that. Definitely.
Good morning. Here are some of the stories at NPR News is following. U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez was under fire yesterday. He appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senators challenged his truthfulness and ability to lead the Justice Department. Gonzalez refused to answer whether the White House was on solid legal ground in contending that Congress cannot force the Justice Department to pursue a possible congressional contempt citation against the administration or its current or former aides. Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy said the Attorney General's lost the confidence of the Congress and the American people. The River Thames overfloweth today. The river burst its banks and forced the evacuation of hundreds of homes in Oxford. Britain is in the midst of its worst floods in 60 years. About 350,000 people have faced 2 weeks without running water. Insurance claims could soar to $6.2 billion. And it's close, but no cigar for Barry Bonds. He went 1-for-5 with a single and a walk last night when the Giants met Atlanta. Bonds is still shy 2 home runs of Hank Aaron's 755 home run record. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org.
Hey, Allison, do you know how many, if you had to take a wild guess, how many self-storage units would you say there are in America? Or at least how much room do you think they would take up?
Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine. They're in Los Angeles, as you know, there are just entire towns that seem to be storage.
Yeah, and these are just the ones that you have the key to. Then there are other kinds. They're basically enough to cover up San Francisco and Manhattan combined, just of this one kind of subset of storage units that people are using. And actually, also, there was a survey that 1 in 3 IKEA customers said that they found cleaning out their closet to be more gratifying than sex.
Wow.
Which clearly some of those people were former girlfriends.
I don't shop at IKEA, fortunately.
Actually, these are these factoids and more can be yours if you read this awesome article that was in Mother Jones, written by Elizabeth Gettleman. It was sort of about how obsessed Americans are with trying to get organized. And Elizabeth Gettleman joins us now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
This was a great piece that you wrote, but it sort of made me wonder about the fact that, you know, houses, everyone talks about houses are getting bigger and, you know, people are moving to the exurbs and getting more and more room, and yet it seems like people are having a harder and harder time getting their crap organized. What's going on?
Well, I mean, they're moving to bigger houses. You know, the average American home has grown by 80% since the 1970s, and yet we still, people are keeping more and more stuff. So, you know, you have families who, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, everyone seems has a self-storage unit. There's 7 square feet of commercial storage space for every single American. You have people who move into bigger houses so they can have, you know, one family in Massachusetts had to actually downsize to a smaller house, and the mother was really upset until they figured out how to convert their den, their living room, into a Costco annex so they could sell their Costco bulk goods.
That is the most depressing thing I've ever heard.
It's pretty wild.
What do you think it is about getting organized that is so psychologically gratifying? I know that when I actually get my stuff sort of set up and it just feels so good. Has anyone actually studied that, or is that a sense, is that growing? Are people getting more into that?
Yeah, I mean, people, there is a lot of research out there, and, you know, it's something that, you know, you'll see some academic studying, but you also see a lot of corporate research. You know, there's a lot of money in kind of the soothing power of Tupperware, so to speak. I mean, people maybe can't get a handle around on their debt and their job and their love life, but, you know, if they can figure out where those tops to their Tupperware, you know, containers are, and they can have organizers for their closets, you know, they'll have, that's something they can control, and they'll find inner peace that way. And you have places like the Container Store and IKEA, and, you know, they see their, you know, salespeople as, you know, therapists in a way. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this year that talked about the Container Store guy wants to be your therapist.
Yeah, I used to work at the Seattle version of one of those. It was called Storables Extra Space, which I can't even believe I'm giving them a plug because I hated that place so much. But yeah, it was totally like that. People would come in with, and you would really be helping them out if you could just find a place for them to put their, you know, their tchotchkes.
And it's also seen as sort of a getaway from sometimes the big house in the suburbs. I mean, there's a chain called Garage Town, and now I'm doing a shameless plug, and I have nothing to do with them, but they sell condominium storage units. They come with refrigerators, cable TV hookups. They have a members-only clubhouse at each site with showers. So the idea is, it's your escape home away from home. You can store stuff there, but you can also go and kick back and
hang out with your Peter Frampton records.
Exactly.
Awesome. Elizabeth Gettleman of Mother Jones Magazine, thanks for writing this article, and thanks for telling us about it.
Sure, and people can find it either on the newsstands or at motherjones.com.
Well, look, you know, there are people who like to organize their homes and those who need to organize. But then there are those people who really can't. Those compulsive hoarders are people for whom the collection of their things, many, many, many things, may seem normal to them, but can lead to a life drowning in everything that they have collected and they feel they have to keep. Dr. Randy Frost joins us. He's an expert on compulsive hoarding. And Dr. Frost, just so we're clear, can you describe for me what I might find in someone who is a hoarder, their home, versus someone who's just a, you know, an average old pack rat?
Well, for someone who suffers from compulsive hoarding, typically they've acquired and been unable to discard so many items that there is significant clutter in the living spaces of their home, making it impossible for them to, for instance, sleep in their bed or sit on a couch or eat at a table or and sometimes even move through the rooms in their home.
Is there a profile of a hoarder? Is it age, gender? How many hoarders do we think there are out there, actually?
Well, our best estimate right now, and it's been going up with each passing year, is that somewhere between 2 and 4% of the population suffer from significant hoarding problems. And the severity ranges from mild to all the way to life-threatening. The life-threatening circumstances typically involve those where there's a risk of fire. And we've seen a number of cases, even in the past year, of people who have lost their lives because their homes were so full that they caught on fire easily and they couldn't escape.
There's a very famous kind of fireman's call in New York. They say, we've got a Collier, based on the Collier brothers who were found in that brownstone just surrounded with newspapers to the ceiling where they almost made like a rat trail to be able to live. These people... Could you tell from their outward appearance that they might be going through this at home, or do these people seem normal to people that they work with or interact with at the store every day?
Well, that's the interesting thing about the disorder. It seems as though for many of these folks, you would never have an idea that their homes were difficult to live in or in some cases nearly impossible to live in. Some people you can tell because for many people who hoard, they tend to carry more things with them.
Really?
They tend to fill whatever space they have available, so their cars are frequently full of things. And so sometimes you can tell from those kinds of things, but often you would not know meeting someone, talking to someone.
Dr. Frost, what makes up a hoarder's belief system? What do they think they're gaining by holding on to all this stuff?
Well, there are a couple of different things that seem to attach people to possessions, and some of them are emotional attachments, sentimental attachments. Now, the interesting thing about hoarding is that the attachments people have to their possessions are exactly the same as the attachments all of us have to possessions. We all save things for sentimental reasons.
Sure.
But people who hoard save a wider variety and a greater number of things for those sentimental reasons, and they come to feel like they're part of them, part of their identity. So they try to get rid of that bank envelope that is empty and just has a note written on it. It feels like they're losing a part of themselves. So there's a tendency to not want to experience that feeling, so they keep the bank envelope, even though they really have nothing that's going to happen to it, nothing that's going to do with that bank envelope, but it just stays on the pile in the middle of the room.
So if you went to a hoarder's home while they were away and you cleaned it out, that would be very threatening.
It would be very threatening, yes. And in the long run, it wouldn't be much help to the person. It might change the safety of the home temporarily, but the behavior itself would not change.
It's interesting you use the word behavior, because is this a behavior or a psychological disorder or a syndrome? What's the correct language?
Well, for right now, hoarding is considered a symptom of obsessive-compulsive disorder, and also a symptom of obsessive-compulsive personality disorder. Exactly what will happen to hoarding in the next version of the diagnostic manual is unclear. It looks like this might be somewhat separate from both of those disorders, and it may end up being a diagnosis in and of itself.
And before I go, is it something that's treatable?
Yes, we've recently developed a treatment protocol for compulsive hoarding and had pretty good luck in the initial research that we've done on the effectiveness of the treatment protocol.
Dr. Frost, give me a website where people can go to get more information.
The best website is the Obsessive Compulsive Foundation website. It's ocfoundation.org.
Dr. Randy Frost, we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Allison, we did it.
Done and done. I'm going to go clean my desk right now.
Yeah, we made it through. Me in Chicago, in what I like to call the sensory deprivation tank. You in New York. Guests, we learned, we laughed, we loved. And we're going to do it again next week, I think.
All right. I'm looking at Matt Martinez. I'm looking at Dan Pashman. I am looking at MJ Davis. I'm looking at Wynn Rosenfeld. I'm looking at Neil. Neil, I don't know your last name, our engineer.
Roush.
Neil Roush. Thank you so much to our crew for helping us put on the Bryant Park Project. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. See ya.